Today is Tuesday, January 13th, Monday, January 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, protests continue in Iran, with many asking leaders to step down after the downing of a Ukrainian plane last week.
There appears to be widespread public anger at the government's initial attempt to deny responsibility for shooting down the plane.
Plus, where do talks go with North Korea after Pyongyang signals no interest in sitting down again with the United States? And what's next for House Democrats as they prepare to send articles of impeachment to the Senate? Those stories and more are next. Video on social media appears to record gunshots and blood on the streets of Tehran as huge crowds demonstrate following Iran's admission that it mistakenly shot down a Ukrainian passenger plane. Reuters' David Doyle starts us off.
Iranian police are denying firing at protesters after video on social media appear to record gunshots and pools of blood in the streets of Tehran. Huge crowds demonstrated in the Iranian capital and other cities at the weekend after authorities admitted mistakenly shooting down a Ukrainian passenger plane, killing all 176 people on board, including Iranian citizens. But on Monday, the head of Tehran's police said officers, quote, absolutely did not shoot and had been given orders to show restraint. The online footage purports to be recording events near Tehran's Azadi Square. Other posts showed riot police hitting protesters with batons. Reuters could not independently authenticate the videos. Public fury, rumbling for days after Wednesday's plane crash, erupted after the military's mea culpa. The plane was shot down hours after Iranian missile strikes on Iraqi military bases housing U.S. coalition troops. The strikes retaliation for the U.S. killing of top general Qassem Soleimani, the second most powerful man in Iran. At the weekend, Donald Trump voiced his support for Iranians and told authorities, don't kill your protesters. On Monday, according to state media, an Iran government spokesman dismissed the U.S. president's, quote, crocodile tears, saying Iranians would remember he had killed Soleimani and was the reason many were facing economic hardship.
That was Reuters reporter David Doyle. Now, to explore the topic of what's taking place in the region further, we're joined via Skype by Stratfor senior military strategist Omar Lamrani. Omar, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Omar, so let's start with the protest, because we saw on television following the killing of General Soleimani protests against the United States. And now there's these anti-government protests after the government of Tehran acknowledged that they shot down the Ukrainian jet. And is this the same kind of protest we saw against the government for months leading up in the waning weeks of 2019?
I think it's largely the same type of population that's protesting against the government here again. I think it speaks to the divisions that are in Iran. There's a lot of anger towards the government. There's a lot of anger in the streets that the government is corrupt, that it has not delivered their economic promises, that does not take care of its people while it continues adventurism abroad. But at the same time, we must not forget the massive crowds that's also turned out for Soleimani's funeral, which also really highlights that there's also a very substantial part of the population that remains wedded to the government and its policies.
So what does this mean for Iran moving forward with these protests gearing up again?
I think it's really, first of all, there's the issue of how does Iran handle the protests in terms of cracking down or not. So that's always a very sensitive issue. I can imagine that they will try to show some initial restraints, but it can easily turn ugly. I mean, we've seen that happen multiple times before when the leadership thinks that these protests are taking it too far. But on the wider front and the regional front, I think it also puts more pressure on the government, at least the hardliners, will push for this, which is to strike back at the United States, because they see that a lot of this anger is linked to the heavy economic sanctions that are on Iran that is weakening their ability to deliver on the economic platform. And so that's part of the reason and very much linked to it's actually why Iran has been very aggressive in the last year or more. And I think that that's likely to continue the more they feel under pressure at home.
You mentioned possible retaliation by Tehran against Washington. Tehran had said that as long as there's no more action taken by the United States, the strike on the two Iraqi bases were it. Can you comment really briefly on what you see as going forward in the region since Iraq has asked for a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops and what the security status looks like in the future?
So we're unlikely to see direct overt Iranian military action like we saw with these highly publicized rocket strikes or missile strikes on Al-Assad airbase. But the proxy war is going to continue. And then Iraq is going to be a major battlefield in that sense, where Iran has a lot of militias that is it has built up over time that it's going to push in parliaments to push out the United States. So we may have seen a de-escalation from the immediate danger of an overt war between Iran and the United States, but that proxy conflict that's initially led to the killing of the American contractor that then escalated to the missile strikes, that's still very much going to be there. That has just the same way it's escalated then, it's going to escalate going into the future.
Omar Lamrani is a senior military strategist with Stratfor. He's joining us via Skype. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Talks aimed at agreeing to an unconditional and open-ended ceasefire in Libya failed to achieve a breakthrough on Monday despite making good progress. That was according to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. He said some sides in the conflict had signed the ceasefire deal, but that Khalifa Haftar, commander of the eastern-based Libyan National Army faction that has been trying to conquer the capital of Tripoli, asked for more time to consider the matter. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said Haftar had asked until Tuesday morning to consider the deal. Libya's warring leaders held indirect peace talks in Moscow Monday with Russian and Turkish officials urging the rivals to sign a binding truce to end a nine-month-old war and pave the way for a settlement that would stabilize the North African country. A North Korean official says the United States and South Korea are dreaming if they think that U.S. President Donald Trump sending a birthday message would get leader Kim Jong-un back to the negotiation table. Foreign Ministry advisor Kim Kwan repeated the North's deep frustrations over stalled nuclear negotiations with the Trump administration and stressed that the country will never fully deal away its nuclear capabilities for ending the U.S.-led sanctions despite its economic difficulties. He also ridiculed Seoul, saying it was clinging to its role as mediator between Washington and Pyongyang. White House National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien said the United States had reached out to North Korea seeking to resume talks, according to an interview that was published Sunday by Axios. Joining us now on the phone is Harry Kazianis, Senior Director of Korean Studies at the Center for the National Interest. Harry, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
So, Harry, what do you make out of the current status of the prospects for talks with North Korea?
Not good right now. I think the North Koreans are still, to be quite frank, sulking after what happened in Hanoi. Kim Jong-un lost obviously a lot of face back home when he expected to sign a deal with Donald Trump. And I don't think they're really over that. I think probably for the next few months, the North Koreans are probably going to be a wait-and-see mode. I don't think really right now they're going to be testing any missiles or nuclear weapons. They usually do that in the spring. That's when they do a lot of those type of tests, according to historical analysis and just the data from the last 10 years. So I think for the next couple of weeks and the next couple of months, it's just going to be a lot of talking, a lot of back and forth between both sides, and not a lot happening, unfortunately.
If we take a look at the discussions that took place on the Peninsula. We had the three summits between Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un in 2018, and then really nothing of substance came out of those in 2019. Are we going back to, say, the status quo between North Korea and the rest of the world?
It seems so. I think that suits North Korea just fine. If one thing is happening, if the North Koreans are able to either weaken the sanctions regime or China and Russia will weaken the sanctions regime. Always the problem with the maximum pressure policy is that 90% of North Korea's exports go through China. So China essentially underwrites the maximum pressure policy. They're the ones who decide if it succeeds or fails. So I think right now the Chinese, at least there's some anecdotal evidence to show that they have weakened the sanctions a little bit. And it's quite interesting that the North Koreans did not fire off their big Christmas gift that we were all expecting.
Or New Year's gift, right?
Exactly. So I think what we saw was, is I think the North Koreans were very happy that Moscow and Beijing put forward different resolutions at the UN trying to weaken the sanctions. And I think that might have been a message to North Korea saying, hey, look, if you're not going to rock the boat, not going to rock the status quo, we may be able to unofficially weaken these sanctions if the United States won't go along with it. And I think that goes a long way to explaining what you're seeing right now.
In his address to essentially the world, Kim Jong-un said that, you know, he was no longer going to be bound by a cessation of nuclear and ballistic and intercontinental ballistic missile tests. You think, you just said that, you know, you're not going to probably see anything anytime soon. What do you think may, you know, push Kim Jong-un to change his mind and conduct those kind of tests?
Well, I think if I'm Kim sitting in Pyongyang, I'm thinking that the best time to get a deal, and if a deal is going to happen, is after Trump is basically free from all the impeachment circus. So once Donald Trump is inevitably acquitted by the Senate, I think Kim would naturally expect that Trump would have a little bit more political clout to make some concessions to Pyongyang if he wanted to.
Do you think he'll do it then or wait till after the November election when they know who the next president will be?
Well, I think the North Koreans would be willing to talk and maybe on their end even give a little bit more if they knew Donald Trump was going to come to the table specifically with sanctions relief. I mean, that's pretty clear that that's what they want. So if Donald Trump is willing to offer some sort of sanctions relief, even if it's in a snapback sort of situation where the North Koreans would have to close maybe the Yongbyon nuclear facility and Trump would offer maybe coal and textiles on the table for export and relieving those sanctions, I think the North Koreans would be game. But if the Trump administration continues on with maximum pressure, wants full denuclearization before giving up anything, I think this spring we're going to see a lot of missiles and specifically ICBMs in the sky.
Harry Kazianis is the Senior Director for Korean Studies at the Center for the National Interest. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Experts have warned that the Taal volcano in the southern portion of the Philippines could erupt and have called for evacuations. Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
On Sunday, ash blasted into the air, followed by rumbling and tremors at the Taal volcano, 70 kilometers south of the Philippines' capital, Manila. But these plumes of ash could quickly turn into something more dangerous. Authorities have raised the danger level to 4 out of 5. With thousands of residents being evacuated from nearby towns. The Taal volcano is one of the smallest active volcanoes in the world. It's erupted more than 30 times in the past 5 centuries, and in 1911 it killed 1,500 people. The plume of ash has drifted into the capital, forcing cancellation of flights and closure of schools and government work. Authorities have also warned of the risk that an eruption could cause a tsunami.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan, and you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In December, an online report on the Astronomer's Telegram website indicated the star Betelgeuse was decreasing in brightness. This set off headline-grabbing speculation that the variable red supergiant star was getting ready to explode into a spectacular supernova. Since then, a number of astronomers have refuted this assumption, with some saying it might go supernova in about 10 to 100,000 years from now. Astronomers at Louisiana State University, citing their research, recently suggested that a binary system called V Sagittae will explode when the two stars crash into and merge with each other around the year 2083. They say that this explosion will make it the most luminous star in the Milky Way galaxy. The binary system is currently described as being barely visible, even with mid-sized telescopes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the House Democrats will vote on Tuesday on when to send the articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump to the Senate. Pelosi told ABC's This Week on Sunday she always had intended to send the articles of impeachment to the Senate, but there is a reason why she delayed doing so.
What we did want, though, and we think we accomplished in the past few weeks, is that we wanted the public to see the need for witnesses with firsthand knowledge of what happened, documentation, which the president has prevented from coming to the Congress as we review this.
Joining us on the phone from Capitol Hill is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Welcome to the program, Catherine.
Thanks.
So, Catherine, what can you tell us about this meeting that House Democrats are going to have tomorrow that Pelosi said they're going to vote on when to send the articles of impeachment over to the Senate?
basically, tomorrow is the regular weekly House Democrats caucus meeting. This is something they hold every week that they're in session. But what they'll be doing is really developing a strategy going forward in terms of the House impeachment managers, who are really important. They play this important role over in the Senate trial. There's a lot of discussion up here on Capitol Hill about who Nancy Pelosi will nominate. We're almost certain that House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff will be one of those impeachment managers, as well as House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler. But there could be as many as 10 of those managers. And the thinking is that a woman and a person of color will also need to be included in those numbers. So that'll be part of the discussion.
So if they choose to go ahead and send the articles over in their caucus meeting on Tuesday, what kind of timeline are we looking at for the delivery to the Senate and when a possible trial may begin?
Sure. So after the Tuesday morning strategy meeting, the earliest they could vote is Tuesday evening. It could even come later in the week. The latest it would be Thursday of this week. Then there's going to be a couple of days needed for preparation over in the Senate for that trial to get rolling. And, of course, remember that we're also moving into a three-day holiday weekend, the Martin Luther King holiday. My guess is that senators will want to have that three-day weekend before they take on the enormous challenge of a six-day-a-week impeachment trial.
Catherine Gibson reports from Capitol Hill for VOA. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're so welcome.
There were huge crowds of protesters over the weekend as thousands took to the streets to hold rallies again in Hong Kong. The peaceful crowds were not as massive as some have been in the past, and the city did not see the level of violent incidents experienced between protesters and police as they did in the past. The global head of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, said he was denied entry on Sunday to Hong Kong, where he was scheduled to launch the organization's latest world report this week. In a video he posted on Twitter, Roth said that he was blocked from entering Hong Kong for the first time, having entered freely in the past.
I'm standing here in Hong Kong International Airport. I had flown in from New York with the hope of holding a press conference on Wednesday to release Human Rights Watch's annual world report. And the focus of the report this year was going to be how the Chinese government is really trying to deliberately undermine the international human rights system, not simply suppress the rights of people at home, but also undermine the ability of anybody else to try to hold China to human rights standards.
Human Rights Watch, which is based in New York here in the United States, had been scheduled to release its 652-page World Report 2020 at the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong on January 15th. Roth now plans to launch the report on January 14th at the United Nations in New York, according to the organization. China's foreign ministry said Roth's denial of entry into Hong Kong was Beijing's sovereign right and that the government has always acted in accordance with the law. Also, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, said the city's strengths as a global financial hub had not been undermined by the months of pro-democracy protests. Speaking at the opening of a regional financial forum, Lam said the city's financial system remained stable thanks to the lessons learned since the Asian financial crisis. Lam cited the Hong Kong stock listing of e-commerce giant Alibaba Group Holding as encouraging for other listings by mainland China companies. Chinese state councillor Wang Yi said that separatists will leave a stink for 10,000 years, a direct quote from him, in Beijing's most strongly worded reaction yet to Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen's re-election on the back of a message of standing up to Beijing. Tsai was returned to office on Saturday by a landslide in an election dominated by China's growing efforts to get the island it claims as its own to accept Beijing's rule. Tsai said upon claiming victory that Taiwan would not give in to threats and intimidation from China and that only Taiwan's people had the right to decide their own future. A toxic standoff continues between Venezuela's authoritarian leader Nicolas Maduro and the opposition party led by Juan Guaido, whom the U.S. backed as president after allegedly corrupt elections in 2018 brought Maduro back to power for a second six-year term. The situation worsened on January 5th when Maduro's allies and some rogue opposition members of the National Assembly physically prevented Guaido from taking his oath as president of Venezuela's National Assembly and installed Maduro's choice instead, further tightening up his grip on power. VOA Adams Phillips has more on the crisis and the impasse.
Venezuela has been brewing for some time, says Alejandro Velasco, professor of Latin American history at New York University, who has written extensively on modern Venezuela.
What we've been seeing over the past 2 to 5 years is a situation of tremendous economic crisis and at the same time, significant political stalemate, where on the one hand, you have the presidency of Nicolas Maduro, really battling a tremendously adverse economic situation as a result of the collapse of oil prices, but also waning popular support in the context of being very uncharismatic, far more authoritarian, and increasingly repressive as his resources become scarce.
The crisis intensified last year when Juan Guaido, an opposition legislator, not only assumed presidency of the National Assembly, but also declared that he was Venezuela's constitutionally selected interim president. The United States and several other countries recognized him as the country's president. Tensions heightened again on January 5th when Maduro's proxies seized control of the legislature.
This they did without the quorum or the necessary number of lawmakers even being there in the chamber. So the entire thing was irregular and done against the constitution and legislative norms in the country.
That's Jeff Ramsey, Venezuela director for the Washington Office for Latin America. He predicts this move will produce mixed results for Maduro.
I think in the short term, Maduro has succeeded in highlighting the divisions in the opposition, and he has really failed in showing how this is all going to work to his favor in the long term, because this doesn't really solve the equation for Maduro. He's not going to get sanctions relief. He's not going to escape international pressure on the path that he's under.
Alejandro Velasco says the United States and other countries gambled when they supported Guaido.
They thought that he was more powerful than he was. They thought that he had more support in the military, especially, which is an incredibly powerful institution in Venezuela, than he in fact had. And they assumed that with the support of the United States and other countries in Latin America and in Europe who recognized Guaido as the interim president, that the Maduro government would fall. And it didn't. Instead, Maduro was able to find support from places like Russia, China, and Turkey to remain in power.
Venezuela's government has been nearly paralyzed. Maduro and his allies refuse to work with Guaido and his backers. Neither side even recognizes the other's legitimacy.
What we've seen over the last few days, and really over the last couple of months, is a new language coming out of the White House to suggest that what we need in Venezuela is a negotiated solution rather than the overthrow of one party over another. And that is hopeful language, because that's what many people in Venezuela have long been talking about and clamoring for.
Velasco says that despite that hope, compromise will probably prove elusive in 2020. For nearly two decades, Venezuela has been deeply polarized between supporters of President Hugo Chavez, who died in 2013, and those who opposed him. That polarization leaves the government unable to move forward on hyperinflation, shortages of food and medicine, the near collapse of the country's infrastructure, and murder and migration rates that are among the highest in the world. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
World stock markets were a mixed bag on Monday as investors turned their attention to the planned signing of a China-U.S. trade pact, with Wall Street firmer and European markets mostly retrenching. London bucked the sluggish European trend thanks to a weaker pound, which boosts share prices of multinationals that earn in dollars. Also on Monday, Wall Street rebounded in morning business as analysts agreed that the Federal Reserve will likely maintain interest rates low for some time to come. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Dan Brown, and our engineer, John Dryden, thank you very much for spending part of your day with us. You can visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You'll also be able to find archived copies of the show on the program page under the Live Radio tab. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.